simple title to the lesson today, as opposed to some of the titles of my lessons, balance. That's the topic I'd like to address this morning in the course of this lesson, balance. The more I think about it, the more I'm impressed with the need for balance in our lives, in our individual spiritual lives, and in the work of the church. It's been said that for every action, there is an opposite and equal reaction. And I'm afraid then, if I can make a bad application of that law of nature, that's the way some people seem to look at it when it comes to spiritual matters, that if a person sins or we think he might be doing something wrong, that we're justified in reacting, really overreacting in the opposite direction in an equally bad way. And I see so many examples of that, where people think that if they've got a justifiable criticism, that therefore they're justified in reacting to it in just about any way that they personally deem to be appropriate, when it's really an overreaction. Well, I'll get into some examples later on in this lesson of how we need balance in certain areas of our lives, particularly our spiritual lives. But let me start off, as I oftentimes do, with a definition from the dictionary for balance. It is a harmonious arrangement of parts or elements. And often what we look for when we look for balance is some sort of symmetry. That is, you've got the middle and equal parts or equal weights on each side of the middle. That's the idea of a harmonious arrangement of parts or elements. That balance is something that is very good and very positive, even essential, is shown by the kind of synonyms you find when you go to a thesaurus and look up the word balance. And these are just a few of the synonyms I found. And they're all good, what we would think to be good things. Stability. I mean, do you like or appreciate an unstable person? Do you want your life to be unstable? Stability is something that we appreciate there. Equalization, equality, great idea. Harmony, steadiness, level-headedness. That's just a few of them. But whenever you try to find a synonym for balance, it's like it's always or practically always something that is good. How can balance be deemed a bad thing? Can you think of? Well, perhaps later on we'll get into some examples where it might seem good to deal with a situation by dealing with it more vigorously or even harshly than we ordinarily would. But that is to really done, if it's done at all, to restore balance. So the idea of balance, then, is that everything is in their proper proportions. Again, synonyms for the word balanced, with a D on the end, balanced, fair, equitable, just, impartial. Yes, we like the idea of balance. It's interesting to me that the Lord seems to have provided us with so many good illustrations in the natural world. So I'll refer to some of those forms of balance. If you don't think balance is important, try to buy tires for your car. You ever had to do that? I guess we've all had to do that. Well, what's one thing they want to make sure of before they put those tires on your car? They want to make sure that they're properly balanced. If you try to drive down the road with tires that are not properly balanced, you're going to notice it. But beyond that now, balance is critical to physical life. The reason that the earth, for instance, is so habitable is because of its balance, the balance in nature. For instance, the earth is not too close or too far away from the sun. It's in the right place, the right distance from the sun. If it were too far away, it'd be too cold. If it were too close, it'd be too hot. It's in the right place. The Earth's atmosphere consists of the proper proportion of gases. roughly a fifth of our atmospheric gases, at least at sea level, is oxygen, which, of course, obviously we need for life. But if you inject too much oxygen into the atmosphere, things can become too flammable. So it impresses me with the Lord's wisdom that he has taken care to make sure that everything necessary for our lives is in such proper proportions, is in such balance in our physical world. Even think about this. The earth rotates on its axis at a certain speed and revolves around the sun at speeds, ensuring that day and night and the seasons are not too long or too short, but just the right length, except sometimes when we're in the dead of winter, we wish it would be a little bit shorter. But moving on from this, accountants and bank tellers want their books and records to balance at the end of the day or the month or week or what have you. Again, for another example, the difference between a poison or a medicine often is a matter of balance. There was a fellow who lived in the early 1500s by the name of Paracelsus. And he seems to be described as some father of modern pharmacy, something like that. He kind of thought highly of himself because his name, Paracelsus, might have been a Frenchman. That was not his original name. There was a fellow like him, a physician, I think a Roman physician, from the first century A.D., named Celsus. Paracelsus thought he was superior to Celsus, so he added the word para, which is the Greek word for beyond. He called himself Paracelsus. I've gone beyond Celsus in the development of medicines. But anyway, he got some things right, apparently. He said, all substances are poisons. There is none which is not a poison. The right dose differentiates a poison and a remedy. He's really talking about balance there. When you think about water, water is absolutely essential to life. But if you get too much of it, you drown. We have a friend in Georgia who told us about his son who was drinking too much water. And he went into some sort of seizure because he was drinking too much water. I'm not sure if I'd even heard of that before. But apparently it is a medical phenomenon. You can drink too much water. Balance is also critical to social and psychological life. A well-rounded or balanced personality is one that is good. Someone who is mentally ill or psychologically troubled is described as being imbalanced. And of course, balance is very important to political and national life. If you know much about civics, you've heard of the system of checks and balances in our government. The U.S. Constitution provides for a system of checks and balances so that one arm of government may not become overly powerful at the expense of the other arms of government. Now for biblical application. The Lord showed his regard for balance by insisting upon fairness in the scales. There several passages to this effect, but might as well start with Leviticus 19, verse 16. You've probably seen that the emblem of justice, for instance, is a woman blindfolded holding up what? Scales. Another word for scales? Balances. Balances. But in Leviticus 19, verse 36, it says, you shall do no wrong in judgment, in measurement of weight or capacity. You shall have just balances, just weights, a just ephah, and a just hin. I am the Lord your God who brought you out from the land of Egypt. You shall have just balances. The idea of justice and balance just naturally seem to come together, don't they? And then, of course, a couple of passages along these lines I found over in Proverbs. First of all, 11, verse 1. Which says, a false balance is an abomination to the Lord, but a just weight is his delight. And then chapter 16, verse 11. A just balance and scales belong to the Lord. All the weights of the bag or his concern. So even the Bible brings together the ideas of justice and balance. Because this has to do with basic fairness and honesty and justice. Being spiritually right, then, often involves having the proper balance of virtues. It bothers me fairly frequently that I observe some people and myself, because I have to ask myself about this sometimes, and they seem to be so strong, so virtuous in their pursuit in one area of their lives, with particularly one or two or three virtues in their lives, even to the extent that they overlook perhaps the others. It's wrong to develop one virtue in our lives or one skill in our lives entirely to the neglect of the others. Now, it's been said that too much of a good thing is not good. And I believe that's the point of the writer of Proverbs, again, in the book of Proverbs, chapter 25, verse 16. He asked the question, have you found honey? Eat only what you need, lest you have it in excess and vomit it. As a matter of fact, we're even told in the next book of the Bible, Ecclesiastes, chapter 7, verse 16. This may sound kind of strange at first to you, but it actually says, do not be excessively righteous and do not be overly wise. Why should you ruin yourself? Excessive righteousness there would refer to self-righteousness, that is, a righteousness beyond what the Bible would, or even good sense would prescribe for us. For an example of that would be in Luke 18, verse 12, where the Pharisee who went to the temple to pray prayed, I fast twice a week. The Old Testament did not tell him to fast twice a week. As far as we know, the Old Testament only called upon the Jews to fast once a year. But now here's this fellow. He's going to go beyond that. He's going to fast not just twice a year, but twice a week. Self-righteousness. Going to an extreme. Losing balance in his spiritual life. So there must be a balance struck between excess at one extreme and inadequacy at the other extreme. Okay, now that's the principle. Let's make some applications of the need for balance in our spiritual lives, or really in our entire lives, because our entire lives relate to our spiritual lives. But we need balance in or between, in this case, in our preaching and teaching. Some preachers and teachers focus on one doctrine at the expense of others. I can understand that. As a matter of fact, for at least relatively brief periods of times, we may need to focus more intensely on certain ideas or false doctrines and expose them. And that may require more focus on that subject, more intense Bible study on that subject. But then we eventually need to return to focusing on the Bible as a whole and not neglect other ideas or doctrines or virtues that the Bible tells us about. We don't want to focus on one doctrine throughout our lives or much of our lives at the expense of others. Situations, as I said, do sometimes require that more attention be given to one doctrine. However, over the course of a year or over the course of a lifetime, we need to look back and ask ourselves, is there balance that can be observed in the contents of our preaching and teaching? I don't know that I do a very good job of this. You might be a better judge of that than I am. But every once in a while, I will think about what I have been preaching on. I look back several months or over the course of a year or even longer and ask myself, have I been focusing too much on this area and neglecting this area? It can be easy to do that, especially at times when preachers are faced with situations in which false doctrine is being particularly threatening, and at those times, they may need to focus really intensely on those particular subjects. But as I said, when the danger has been met, and we would hope largely passed, then we need to return to a greater balance in our preaching and teaching. The listeners and their needs, rather than an artificial or obsessive interest in one subject, should be the factor in determining what is taught. I think I have sometimes observed things like that, if not in my life, and in the lives and in the work of other preachers. They become so caught up, perhaps, in one or a few subjects that there's something else lacking in their personal lives. Perhaps they have not focused on those virtues as much as they should have. I think I can see this on a larger scale. When we were going through, when I say we, talking about members of the Lord's church, we're going through an intense period of crisis and debate over institutionalism, and I won't stop to define it all right now, but it really came on pretty heavily in the 50s, and there was a lot of struggle about that. 50s and on into the 60s, and I personally saw that. I saw that in my family, had to deal with that, in my father did particularly. And, I mean, there was a lot of ink committed to that subject. And it has separated brethren from one another. Well, we largely got beyond that period of struggle. And basically, decisions were made. Churches and individuals made their decisions as to which way they were going to go and so forth. And I guess I could say I have feared that because younger generations look back upon that older generation and have seen so much focus upon certain things, like institutionalism and the battle with the ideas of institutionalism, that they thought, oh, you know, well, that was overdone. And people were so focused upon that struggle that they neglected other important virtues. And that may be true. That very well may be true. But I fear that on the part of younger generations, and this is, I suppose, typical of all generations, the younger generations kind of look back on the older generations and they think, you know, they just didn't get it right. They didn't have the proper balance. And at least in some individual cases, that might have been correct. And they might say, in this particular case, well, they got wrapped up in legalism and all these petty legalistic arguments. And they have turned away from that. And perhaps now there's an overemphasis upon grace. And grace might be interpreted as we not needing to be so concerned with what to younger generations seem to be these petty distinctions. And I'm afraid then that there's been an overreaction and there's been a loss of balance. So it's very easy, and this is why I talk about balance. You've heard of going from one extreme to the other. I've seen that in the lives of individuals and in the lives of God's people as a whole. They seem to go from one extreme to the other extreme. Okay, if somebody's out here in this extreme, or we think they're, why can't we just bring it back to the middle? Why do we have to react by going to the other extreme? Paul strove for balance. In Acts 20, we see that he strove for balance in his preaching and in his teaching. In Acts 20, beginning with verse 20, we note there that he says, "How I did not shrink from declaring to you anything that was profitable and teaching you publicly and from house to house." There are two forms of balance that he cites there, really. First of all, I didn't shrink back, he says, from telling you anything that was profitable. It wasn't just on one subject, but whatever your needs were, not what my interests were, but whatever your needs were, I addressed that. There was evidently balance in his teaching. But also the second kind of balance he indicates there is, where are he talking? He said, I talk publicly and from house to house. So there was a balance in his personal and in his public efforts to teach there. But also, look down in verse 27. He says, for I did not shrink from declaring to you the whole counsel of God. He did not focus on one subject to the neglect of the others. So as I wind up this particular application of what I say, think about the kinds of balance that we need to have in our preaching and teaching. We need to have balance. Or be careful to apportion our time in study to, for instance, Old and New Testament studies. I would certainly agree that when a person is being taught to become a Christian, and for a while thereafter, there needs to be more of a focus upon the New Testament, because the New Testament tells him what he needs to do to become a Christian and how he needs to behave as a Christian. I understand that. But then once Christians have started to develop beyond that point, it's hard for me to say that it's any less important to study the Old Testament than it is the New Testament. There are so many good and wonderful lessons in the Old Testament that support New Testament principles. Probably, I'll have to tell you, the one verse, a favorite verse in the Bible for me, I appreciate John 3:16. But the one that has come to the kind of define my life or my approach to teaching and preaching is Proverbs 23, verse 23. Buy the truth and do not sell it. That verse has guided me and basically is for as long as I can remember. Buy the truth and do not sell it. I say that to say that's how important the Old Testament can be. That's in the Old Testament. I can remember not long after I'd started preaching, an older preacher, not a much older preacher, but somewhat older preacher. I think I told him we were studying the minor prophets where I was preaching. Last 12 books of the Old Testament. And he said something to the effect, you need to get over there in the New Testament where you can learn something. I've never forgotten that. We also need a balance between topical and textual studies. I emphasize this because there has been a lot of pressure. Maybe I should say the idea seems to be that, textual or expository studies, where you just take a particular text of the Bible and just basically lecture on it or make comments on it verse by verse, that has become very fashionable today. It really started out in the denominational realm. When I started researching this subject, because I began noticing that brethren were really saying, expository studies, that's the way to go. That's the way to go. I've basically been a topical preacher all my life. Once in a while, I would get into a textual or expository study, but not very often. I've been here long enough, you know how I preach. And I'm not ashamed of that, because when you go to the New Testament, you see examples of sermons there. Take Peter's sermon on the day of Pentecost as recorded in Acts, the second chapter. You could outline it. It has a theme. And various verses are brought into it. It's basically a topical study. Well, you could go to Stephen's defense of himself in Acts, the seventh chapter. It's a topical study. I mean, he doesn't stick with one text, is what I'm trying to say. But this idea, we need textual or expository studies, that's the way to go. That started off in the denominational realm, among denominations. Even to the point I've discovered, you can go to denominational seminaries and get master's degrees, at least, in expository or textual preaching. And I read an article probably back at the end of the 1990s, actually. I read an article written by a brother in a magazine published by Brethren, in which he said, basically, you need to do all your preaching. All your preaching needs to be expository preaching, not topical preaching. Basically said, that's bad. That's bad. You're not doing your job if you do topical preaching. He said, this is almost verbatim what he said, you need to start in the first chapter of a book, verse 1 of that chapter, you need to go verse by verse by verse by verse until you're finished with your time that day. And then the next Sunday or whatever, or the next time you preach, you need to start where you left off. You go verse by verse by verse, and it just continues on that way through the end of the book. Now, that upset me enough that I've actually preached on this particular topic before, and I don't want to turn this point into the whole sermon. But what troubles me about that, for one thing, not only is it an unscriptural idea, but what troubles me about that is because topical preaching gives us something that textual or expository preaching does not. And that is, it gives us flexibility. Flexibility. When there's trouble in the church, when something needs to be addressed in teaching and preaching, when we need to go more deeply on a topic, well, you need topical preaching. It gives us great flexibility. Imagine if I'm going through the book of Romans, and I've started with Romans 1, verse 1, and week after Sunday after Sunday after Sunday I'm teaching on that, and a problem or a question arises that is not addressed in the book of Romans. What do I do? Sorry, I can't deal with that right now. I'm working my way through Romans. This is what we need to do. You see, topical preaching gives us preachers the flexibility that we need to deal with matters in a timely way. But beyond that, and this is a hint as to why I think, and this, if you'll permit me to speculate somewhat, although I don't know this, I don't think this is going too far out on a limb, but I think that's why some may prefer expository preaching, because it inhibits a preacher addressing a subject in a timely manner. It doesn't allow for as much application. So expository preaching then can give people the sense, oh, we're really into Bible study, and isn't that good? But if you'll notice carefully, the application is not there as perhaps it needs to be. And as a matter of fact, just doing expository preaching, that kind of, sure, you can make some application as you're doing that, but not very deep application. Why? Because you've got to get back to the text and work your way through the text. Teachers understand this. They understand that they have to find a balance between, okay, I'm under pressure, I've got to work my way through this section here in the book, got to get through the textbook, I'm under pressure to do that. But then on the other hand, their students may need more in-depth coverage at certain points. And so that's a struggle. They've got to find a balance between covering the text and providing for the needs of their students. That can be pretty hard to do sometimes. We need a balance between positive and negative preaching. We need a balance between doctrinal and practical preaching. You know, those could take up an hour themselves, but let me move on to another application here. We need a balance between praise and criticism. Some people go to extremes with too little praise or too little criticism. Praising a person can be. So much emphasis upon positive reinforcement and praise. And yes, that is very important, as I'll say shortly. But let me suggest this to you. Praising a person can be an inefficient way of helping him see his problems and may create an unrealistic view of himself and his abilities. Sometimes you need to make a very pointed criticism. I really don't like criticism. Some people may find this shocking, but I really don't like criticism. I'm a conflict avoider. At the same time, in principle, I recognize the need for sometimes some criticism, depending on the situation. I will try to find as tactful a way as I can sometimes to criticize. But sometimes criticism is needed. Sometimes it does the job that praise just won't do. I've sometimes made the statement that, when we're having a class study and we come to the exercises and questions and answers involved, and we might have true and false questions or statements, and someone gives the wrong answer. Well, even if they guess, they've got 50% chance of getting it right. But in this case, they went with the other 50% and they got it wrong. So when they give the wrong answer on a true or false question, I don't want to say, oh, you're wrong. I might say, well, does anybody have an alternative answer? But sometimes we just need to say, well, sorry to tell you, but that's wrong, and explain why. On the other hand, of course, too much criticism can be very dispiriting, discouraging to a person. Yes, criticism is often exactly what is needed. It should not supplant praise. In Proverbs 28, verse 4 is the one that I'm going to read now. Those who forsake the law praise the wicked, but those who keep the law strive with them. And chapter 27, let's read verses 5 and 6 here. Chapter 27 of Proverbs, verses 5 and 6. Better is open rebuke than love that is concealed. Faithful are the wounds of a friend, but deceitful are the kisses of an enemy. It's interesting to note, as we're thinking about the proper balance between praise and criticism, that actually I say here Christ praised the seven churches of Asia. Well, I'm going to have to criticize myself there. I think that may be incorrect. I think he praised five of the seven churches of Asia. I think there might have been two who didn't get any praise. But even Sardis, that was said to be dead at the beginning of chapter 3 of Revelation, even there were those among them who would walk with Christ in white, he said, for they were righteous. So Laodicea at the end of chapter 3 might have been the only one that didn't get any kind of praise whatsoever. So I'm going to have to qualify the statement on the screen there to that extent. But anyway, I think the main point still prevails here, that even in the cases of those churches for which Christ had criticism, almost without exception, he praised them where he could. We need to, if we can, when we criticize people, it's best if we can first have a relationship with them so that we might criticize them or they might criticize us. We know, oh, you're my friend. I trust you. You're not doing this because you want to blow out my candle to make yours shine brighter. Okay, let's make another application. There needs to be balance in fathers and mothers. God's plan was for children to be raised by mothers and fathers. Ephesians 6, verses 1 and 2. There's a reason for that, of course. God's smart. He knows what he's doing. God did not allow Adam merely to father Eve's children and then allow her to go off by herself and raise them apart from him. That was not God's plan. And yet either mothers or fathers in today's society may be deemed unnecessary by advocates of modern approaches to family, as is the case in homosexual marriage. Two mothers, two fathers, that's good as a mother and a father. No, that's not the way God planned it. That's because males and females are different. Contrary to what you're hearing lately, they are different. And mothers and fathers complement each other by bringing different teaching techniques to the work of child rearing. Someone, he might have been a child psychologist, but he was saying that as he observed, for instance, families out on the playground or at the park, the children come to the monkey bars. Oh, they want to come across like monkeys on those bars. And the mother's on one side saying, oh, honey, be careful, be careful, be careful. Well, the child does need to be careful. The father's over there saying, oh, go for it, go for it. You can do it, go for it. This is not hard. Things like that. Men and women different. And actually, both of those are needed. There needs to be a balance between the caution of the mother and what would be the other word, the encouragement of the father, if not the aggressiveness of the father, maybe. One can be too much. Well, both mothers and fathers bring a balance to the family that is needed. That's what God planned. Okay, there needs to be a balance in roles and in the skills in the church. Not every player on a football team can be a quarterback. You know, sometimes when I watch football, I've gotten to be a little bit more interested in football as I have really gotten attached to a particular quarterback whose name I will not mention because I found some people don't like him. I think about these poor guys on the scrimmage line there, the linebackers. They get no glory. The quarterback, maybe the running backs, the pass receivers, they get all the glory. So wonderful, so wonderful. We don't even know the names of the linebackers who have to do the blocking. And they take such punishment. How can they stand it? How can they deal with it? We don't even know their names. But yet their roles are absolutely crucial to the game or to victory in the game. And yet they're not appreciated properly like they should be. Well, there's an application in that, of course, to the church. Everybody here is important. Everybody is needed. I understand I'm the focus of attention every Sunday in a setting like this right now. But that doesn't mean I'm more important than others. I mean, how often have, well, those who work with the teaching program for our children understand how important it is and how difficult it can be sometimes to get teachers for these programs, good teachers, sincere teachers who are interested in the spiritual welfare of their students. And it can be so hard to get them sometimes. Even sometimes I find myself when I'm in a situation where I need to call upon someone to pray. Okay, who can I call upon to pray? We need people who are capable in leading prayers. We need people who are capable in leading singing. Oh, you know how important, if you've been in the church for a while, you know how important a good song leader can sometimes be. We need people who will just come here and be in the pews. If you can't do anything but sit in the pew. That's critically important. You don't know how discouraging it can be. I was starting to get a little bit, we picked up here in our numbers here after a while, but you don't know how discouraging it can be when brother so-and-so or sister so-and-so is not here. Where is he? Where is she? That can be discouraging to the other members. And the opposite side of the coin is true also. You can be very encouraging to the others, to the church, by your very presence here. So don't think you don't have an important role or anything you can offer to the church. That is simply not true. 1 Corinthians 12, beginning with verse 14, pictures the church as a body, like the human body, and basically says the members that don't get much attention should not for that reason be regarded as less important. You don't think your little toe is very important? Well, I'm sure you'd change your mind if it were amputated. But anyway, 1 Corinthians 12, verse 14, beginning. For the body is not one member but many. If the foot should say, because I am not a hand, I am not a part of the body, it is not for this reason any the less a part of the body. And I won't take the time now to go over that because it gets somewhat redundant. I don't say that in a critical way, of course, but it gets somewhat redundant with this point in the parts of the human body. But you get the point. Every part of the human body is needed. Every part of the spiritual body is needed. We need to have balance in our recognition of the roles and the skills that are needed in the local church. One person can't do it all by any means. Last example here, our last application. We need balance between practicality and ideality. Both are needed. Both are good. You know, young people especially tend to be ideal. Oh, I'll have to tell you, when I first started preaching, I was overly ideal. Overly ideal. Didn't know what I was getting into. And so I had these big ideas and ambitions, okay? Eventually, reality set in. Now, toward the end of my preaching life, I tell you that I have to struggle against pessimism. Consciously struggling. So I've gone from, you might almost say I've gone from one extreme to the other extreme. What we really need is a balance between practicality and ideality. Both are needed. Ideality is needed because it sees the possibilities. and urges people to aim higher. The downside is that it can be unrealistic to the point of being unsafe. Practicality, on the other hand, is needed because it senses real limitations. Almost hate to mention him, but I'm moved to do it. Who was it? Was it Dirty Harry who said, man's got to know his limitations? And that's true. That's true. So practicality is needed because it senses real limitations and understands how to achieve what is possible. Then it has a downside too. It can devolve into pessimism and even cynicism. You need to be careful. You need to bring it back to the center, balance out that practicality and that ideality. In conclusion, many problems in life are due to imbalance. Sometimes in our physical systems, to use another physical illustration, certain hormones may be out of balance in our bodies. Vitamins, minerals, what have you. They're out of balance. That balance needs to be restored. That's true of our spiritual lives too sometimes. The right balance, of course, can never be achieved unless God is at the center of our lives and we focus on Him. And we use Him as a reference point to restore that balance that we need. Thank you for listening.